Well, after church last Sunday, Joni and I took a short road trip down to the area of Portland. I had an errand to run, and I took my bride with me, and she got lunch at a place down, what was it called, the Wagon Wheel, down out in the middle of country of Portland. And she was nursing a sinus headache, and of course this place that we found on the map was a bowling alley. And it's, she goes, how did I pick this? But the food was pretty good. So we had a nice time. And on the way down, Joni mentioned my sermon that day from Numbers 32. And she noted that as a Sunday school teacher of children, that the curriculum typically jumps. It goes from big point to big point. So when it gets to this point in Numbers where the children of Israel are camped alongside the Jordan River ready to cross, it jumps over Deuteronomy, and it jumps right into Joshua and taking Jericho, and keeps the kids right in the action. And it's easy to wade through, and I'm sure those of you who've read the Bible from cover to cover have been through Leviticus and Numbers, and you think this is like driving through North Dakota. You know, this is the Badlands, this is the barren land, where there's a lot of facts and figures and details and things like that. And I'm hoping that as we go through this and dig into this, that you realize that isn't the case. Joni said to me she's really been enjoying these sermons because a lot of pastors don't preach through them. Maybe for a reason, you know, maybe I should learn something here. But, you know, the Lord led me to this, and I'm trying to be faithful to it. But I have been enjoying it, and I hope you are too as well. And Joni tells me the truth, even though she's my wife, so I know I've got at least one supporter in the midst of all this. But, you know, there was a particular term from last week's message from Numbers chapter 32 that has echoed in my mind this entire week. If you recall, the tribal leaders of Gad and Reuben approached Moses, Eleazar, and the leaders of Israel with a request of a land inheritance on the east side of the Jordan River, where they were camped. And their reasoning was, as they said, it's suitable for livestock, and they had livestock. They were taking assessment of where they were, and they said, this will be good for us. But their basic request was conditioned by a phrase. They said, do not make us cross the Jordan. And I really believe that what they meant was not how it sounded. And it sure tripped Moses' trigger. It set him off. He envisioned another rebellion by a segment of Israel that was going to end up in second verse, same as the first, another cycle of God judging those people for being unfaithful, about not wanting to go across the Jordan, and then, okay, back to the wilderness and another. And that he could envision the second generation dying and leaving poor Joshua with the same mess that he had. He had clearly mulled this over in his head. You know, he knew he wasn't going to go into the land, but he was sure hoping that when it was all done, they were on their way. So he was going to nip it in the bud. That's what my dad would say. He was going to nip it in the bud. So he quoted the Lord here in 32, 11, and 12, but he says, because they have not followed me wholeheartedly. And that is the word that is stuck in my mind, that has rung and echoed in my head this whole week, wholeheartedly. That's why I put it in bold there. Because they have not followed me, they, the first generation, not one of those who were 20 years or more when they came up out of Egypt will see the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And what this is a painting of a burial out in the wilderness, one of many, one of thousands and thousands and thousands. Not one except Caleb, son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, and Joshua, son of Nun, for they followed the Lord wholeheartedly. That word is used twice in the same connection. He says, these big group of people, they did not follow the Lord wholeheartedly. Even partially was not enough. There were two guys of that group, Caleb and Joshua, who were wholehearted. In for the penny, in for the pound. What does that imply then for Israel in their future? Would that second generation make the same mistakes, or would they follow the Lord wholeheartedly? Or would they again wander off into sin and rebellion? Now, do we grasp the concept of wholeheartedly? Now, to affirm the Lord's intent, the first thing I did is I went in and I looked up the dictionary definition of that term. It means completely and sincerely devoted, committed, determined, or enthusiastic. There are other euphemisms: earnestly, genuinely, absolutely, entirely, and boldly. These were people, only two of them at this point. Moses was a third, but he wasn't going in, that were wholehearted. They were in to the end. Those all define the characteristics of Caleb and Joshua. So Moses was challenging the men of Gad and Reuben to have a similarly pure heart, to be wholehearted, to be fully yielded and obedient to Yahweh God, as he and Joshua and Caleb had been, time and again. Now, from where we left off in Numbers 32, there is this interchange back and forth, because Moses is trying to get them really sure. So Moses says, "Are you really committed?" And they said, "Yes, we are really committed." And he says, "Now you're really sure about this?" And yes. And it goes back and forth until Numbers 32, 33 sums it up. Then Moses gave to the Gadites, the Reubenites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, son of Joseph, the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the whole land with its cities and the territories around them. Now, we just saw David in the Psalms talking about Sihon and Og. Why? Because this is important. Because they were the first major victories of Israel coming into the land. And the land that they conquered, Sihon and Og, Bashan, was the root area where the tribes were going to settle: Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. So, this morning, we're going to start out doing a little exploration of the Transjordan area. This is going to be a little bit historical. And so, we're going to pick it up here in Numbers 32, verses 39 through 42, and make a connection of how Manasseh gets tied into this. It says, "The descendants of Machir, son of Manasseh, went to Gilead, captured it, and drove out the Amorites who were there." This is important. "So Moses gave Gilead to the Machirites, the descendants of Manasseh, and they settled there. Jair, a descendant of Manasseh, captured their settlements and called them Havoth Jair. And Nobah captured Kenath and its surrounding settlements and called it Nobah after himself." What do we get from that? It sounds pretty historical. Well, it is. And here's the map. Because on the way there, Joni said to me, "Do you remember the layout of where the tribes were?" And I said, "Yeah, but I..." And so I had to firm that up in my mind. So, all right, Bob Gizmo, trial number three. There we go. Okay, so the Israelites go through the wilderness of Zin right here, which actually is just above Judah. They had to duck down underneath Edom. They came up around Moab, and they're right around in here. Reuben got the lower section. Gad got the middle section. Here's the Ammonites. They drove out the Amorites, and this is Manasseh up in here. But if you notice, there's also Manasseh over here, and you might be thinking, how did Manasseh get the double dip? We're going to get that. That's why we're going to talk about this. And then we have Judah, and this is where Jebus right here was renamed after David took it as Jerusalem. You familiar with that term right there? And you go up the river, and this is called the Lake of Kennesaret, and also known as the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus hung out. So when you get an understanding of where this happens right here, it gives you a little better feel for it. Verses 39 through 40, we learn that Manasseh also stepped up to obtain land in the Transjordan across the river. The descendants of Machir, son of Manasseh, went to Gilead. Gilead is to the north. And captured it and drove out the Amorites. The Amorites were completely pushed out of their land, whoever survived. So Moses gave Gilead to the Machirites, the descendants of Manasseh, and they settled there. Machir was a clan leader in Manasseh. See, while Gad and Reuben were their own tribes, those were two sons of Jacob, they were clearing out the middle and the southern area on the east side of the river right there. Machir led his clan against the Amorites to the north and drove them out. And they claimed Gilead. Moses then gave them a land holding on the east side, the Transjordan, because they were allowed a double portion. Why is that? We reviewed this a couple weeks ago. Because Joseph, who was a son of Jacob, went to Egypt. He was sold by his brothers. He went there. He went to prison. He worked his way up. He became the viceroy to Pharaoh. And when Jacob came back, there's no tribe of Joseph up there because Jacob adopted two of his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and said, even though Manasseh was the younger one, Manasseh was going to get the lion's share, the oldest son's share, and that's why there's two areas named Manasseh up there. In verses 41 and 42, another clan leader of Manasseh also staked claim in the Transjordan by doing the cities. Jair, a descendant of Manasseh, captured their settlements and called them Havoth-Jair. And Nobah captured Kenath and its surrounding settlements and called it Nobah after himself. So there was clusters of settlements, small towns and things around there, north of Gad, in their area now given to Manasseh, which were captured and renamed in the name of their Israelite leaders. So the footprint of the Israelite people were already set in place. So up here, all right, let me grab it again. When you look at this map right up here, if you can read this, this says Havoth-Jair up here in Gilead. So you have Reuben down here, Gad in the middle, and you have Manasseh, the first part here, and up here is Havoth-Jair. So that's actually on the map. What is being said here is factual and true. Israel was starting to establish themselves. They were taking over the land. Okay, now that's the historical part. Now, the bulk of Numbers chapter 33, God says to Moses, I want you to have a detailed record of Israel's travel. So it starts up in Egypt and it goes down and all the places that they camped all along the way, including the 40 years in the desert. And it's some of that is a review and some of it is just the wanderings and whatever. And I didn't want to take you back through that because we've reviewed that a couple of times. But at the very end of the chapter is a really important segment that's going to be the focus of our message this morning. And that is chapter 33, Numbers 33, verses 50 through 56. This is the heart of our lesson. So now that we understand the layouts here, 33:50 through 56. It says, on the plain of Moab, by the Jordan River, across from Jericho. We've heard this description many times. This is where Israel was camped for a while they were taking that whole Transjordan area. The Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols and demolish all their high places. Take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you the land to possess. Distribute the land by lot according to your clans to a larger group. Give a larger inheritance to a smaller group, a smaller one. Whatever falls to them by lot will be theirs, distributed according to your ancestral tribes. But If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your side. They will give you trouble in the land where you will live, and then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. You're going, ooh. Verses 50 through 52. On the plains of Moab, along the Jordan River, across from Jericho, the Lord comes to Moses, and he says, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you cross the Jordan River, when you cross it into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their carved images and their cast idols, and demolish all their high places. This is known as the final sermon of Moses. Moses is speaking to the entire assembly. I thought this picture is great because you've got these people stretching as far as you have, and you have Moses with his arms up here, and this is very dramatic, and I just love it. Because I can get the sense that someday when I'm about to retire and preaching my final sermon, if that day ever comes, of what, how important that is. Moses has given it his all. He's trying to direct them towards the path of godly living as they enter the promised land. They're going to cross the Jordan. They're going to finally get to Canaan. And Yahweh plainly instructs the assembly to drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. It again carries the tone of holy war. Drive out all the inhabitants. Not just evicting them. So you're going to take over their homes and their land and their vineyards and everything they've done. But to literally to cleanse the land from overt idolatry. God says you need to scrub it clean. That is what the idea here is. It's like several years ago I was coming back from turkey hunting and I ran into a swarm of mayflies. And they were about a mile in the road, and they were just splat, 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 splat. And I was literally using my windshield wipers. I don't want to be too graphic, but I mean, my entire Jeep was covered. I did not even go home. I was tired from hunting that day, and I went to a quarter car wash, and I worked and sprayed all that stuff off because I didn't want all those bug remains to stick to my Jeep. It was nasty. You know, so the idea is to cleanse it, to get this stuff off from it, to get rid of the inhabitants. How are they going to do that? To destroy all their carved images, their cast idols, and demolish all their high places. This is pretty close on the heels of the situation that happened at Peor. The men of Israel were seduced by the women of Midian into sexual and spiritual adultery. At the high place at the top of this shrine up on Peor to Baal. 24,000 Israelites died. This was a sore spot. They were still smarting from that. People had lost loved ones and friends. 24,000 Israelites were dead because of this event. And so God says, in order for this to happen, not to happen in the land again. In order to keep this from happening, you have to do this. You have to demolish their carved images. There's a section in Isaiah where it says, you know, the puzzlement of idols is, he said, a guy will go out and cut down a tree, and half of it he'll carve out a god, and the other half he'll use it to warm himself at a fire. Lee, you're a woods guy. You know what I'm talking about. If you took wood craftsmen and you made an idol out of it, does it bestow on it anything but a piece of wood? No. But the people do that. And it says, destroy that. Throw it in the fire. It says, they're cast idols. Things that were made of metal, that were cast in metal. It says, get rid of them. Melt them down. Destroy them. And their high places. They were known, just like Peor, they had the shrines and things like that, and they put them up there because they believed that, first of all, it was higher, it was more holy, and it was closer to their gods. And God says, destroy them. Get rid of all of these things. Don't leave anything. Cleanse it. Get the mayflies off your vehicle. Clean it. All the objects, all the locations, all the practices have to go. God says, cleanse it to prevent it from being a real temptation. And this is a principle that stands through time. In my Sunday school class, we've been talking extendedly about Sodom and Gomorrah. And what is the influence of our society? What in life is a stumbling block to you? Is it the television screen? Is it cable TV? Is it your phone? What part of life is a stumbling block to you that can draw you into things that you shouldn't be there? God says, cleanse it, get rid of it. Or it's always going to be there and nibble at the corners of your mind. In verses 53 and 54, Yahweh then reviews the process by which the land will be distributed, be divided up by tribe. He says, take possession of the land and settle it, for I have given you the land to possess. Take possession of the land and settle in it, for I have given you the land to possess. This is a brief summation of a promise that God had made to Abraham 700 years before. We reviewed that. The time between Abraham and Jacob coming into Egypt, we have 430 years of slavery. We have 40 plus years of them being in the desert. And it's about 700 years of time. And God says, it's time. It's time. Get in there. This is the land that the patriarch was called through from Ur of the Chaldeans. He was a tent living nomad. He had to buy a piece of ground to bury his wife. That's all he owned there at that point in time. For this massive group of people that God described to Abraham when he was still Abram in Genesis 15, verse 5, it says, God took him outside. God is reaffirming what's become known as the Abrahamic covenant. And he says, look up at the sky. Look at all those stars. Count them if you can. Your offspring are going to be like that. And Abraham says, I just take one kid. I just take one son. God says, you're going to get that and more. And here it is, this massive group of people camped out there, the people that Moses is talking to. And they're all spread out, and they're going to cross the river, and they're going to take the land. The very ground that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob lived and camped on and raised their families. It was going to be theirs. This has got to be exciting. He says, distribute the land by lot according to your clan. This process for distributing the land has already been covered a little bit in the end of Numbers 26, when they did the second census. God explained it. Sometimes you may wonder why I repeat things. I learned this one from years and years of teaching. God knows the way our minds work, and very few of us, I won't say of you, of us, learn something from hearing it one time. It's in one ear and out the other. It's usually the second and third and fourth time we hear things. And so God repeats things in Scripture. Even Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard that it was said. And when do they hear it? Because of the retelling. The purpose of that is to form a matrix to get memories in your mind. The key information here was that they would get it by lot. Lot, remember, the high priest had this breastplate, this pouch, and inside there were two stones, the Urim and the Thummim. And they would toss these lots to determine the will of God. This is how it was going to work with the property, the land of Canaan, once they subdued it. God says to a larger group, give a larger inheritance, and to a smaller group, a smaller one. Whatever falls to them by lot will be theirs. There was a question about this Wednesday night. How does that work? What if you had a big area and it didn't work out that way? The lot came first. And so when you go back and you saw the map here, Sherry, can you flip back a couple of slides back to the slides to the one more. There we go. When you take a look at this area, how did they do it? Okay, remember in the second census? And so the tribe of Judah here would draw the lot for this area. And then by the size of their tribe, it would determine how much actual would be. So they're way to the south. And you go way to the north, and you got Asher and Naphtali and Dan, and over here is Manasseh. They drew those areas, and then by the size of their tribe, they got a certain area of land. A smaller tribe would get an area with less land, and a bigger tribe would get a different area that they drew in a bigger amount of land. So really, what was happening with Gad and Reuben was unusual because they were asking for a particular piece of land. That wasn't by lot. That was a question we had last week. It says, distributed according to your ancestral tribes. Now, why did Manasseh get two parts? Well, we know that Jacob adopted two kids. He adopted Ephraim and Manasseh from Joseph as his sons. But why is that? Because Levi did not get a land holding. The Levites, because they stood with Moses and fought with him at the golden calf and different places, they were assigned to take care of the tabernacle and the temple, and they were never given a piece of ground. They were always living in association with worship. That was their job. And so when the spoils of war came in, they were given a share. When the sacrifices were done, they were given a share of the meat. And so they were always provided for because they were the religious or the worship authority there, and they didn't get. So instead of 12 tribes, there was actually 11 because Levite wasn't, so you had the double Manasseh. Does this make sense? Have you ever put this all together in your head before? If you haven't, I see some heads going, good, then that's why you're here. Because God has this factual stuff as well as the spiritual stuff because we are supposed to understand what He laid out for us. That's what Numbers is good for, is we learn and we go, I get this now. This is great. You know, I remember being in Old Testament in seminary and putting pieces together that I had learned here and here and here and going, I love this stuff. So that's why I'm sharing it with you, or you're enduring it one way or the other. But thank you for doing that. Verses 55 and 56. The section closes with a warning. Yahweh God often does this. In a passage where there's potential blessing, there's also a warning. In this warning starts with the word but. After all this positive stuff, go take the land, you've given it, you know, you're fulfilling the promise and everything. He says, but if you do not, drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your side. Every commentator I read in this passage mentioned the word trouble. They would have trouble. Any failure of Israel to follow the word of the Lord would bring trouble. The inhabitants of the land needed to be expelled completely from their midst. Now, whether from sympathy, they're not so bad, or profit, you know, if we keep these people as slaves, it'll make it easier. Our farms and vineyards, we'll have helpers. Or laziness. You know what? I'm sick of killing people. I'm just sick of war. I'm done with this. God says it doesn't matter the reason, but if you do not follow this to the letter, there's going to be consequences. There's trouble. They will be barbs in your eyes and thorns in your side. Do you ever get something in your eye and it hurts and your eye is irritated? I put a game camera out recently in an area that I walked into and realized it was all thistles. And I got in about 15 or 20 feet and things were poking me every direction. And it was like, this is really bad. And it was about this high, you know. And I'm like, oh, no. And I started backing out. And everywhere I went, I got poked. And I said, this is not good. And so I understand this. A barb in your side is not, or eye in your, or a thorn in your side is not a good thing. In short, it would be a source of irritation, of discomfort, of pain, and of temptation. It was completely opposite of the way of life that God had laid it out, including pagan practices and idolatrous worship that they seemed to have a proclivity for, an attraction to. He says, they will give you trouble. You want trouble? You want a knuckle sandwich? You remember you want trouble in the land where you live? And I thought about it this way. You know, if you were shopping for a new home, if you were looking and you went on Zillow or one of those places and looked at it and it has this nice picture and they always get it at the right angle and it's the right price and everything, you go there and you check it out and you really like this house. And so you see the next door neighbor in the backyard and you kind of go over there, you get away from the real estate agent and you say, hey, tell me about this area. And the guy goes, well, it's a really nice house. But we have a lot of crime. We have about once a week the police show up for a domestic abuse call or property damage. We've had some drive-by shootings. We've had property stolen and damaged and things. And he said, this isn't quite the neighborhood that it used to be. Would you jump on the house no matter how much you liked it? And most of you would go, no, I would not willingly go in and take that kind of problems on myself. Now, if you were given God-given authority to drive out all the bad element out of that area by force and make the area good, to take the house that you wanted, would you do it? That's the question. That's what they had. Are you willing to displace the trouble to make your home safe and secure and sound? It sounds much easier. It sounds like, well, of course you would, unless you actually had to do it yourself. This is a challenge. This final warning is aimed right at the core of Israel. God says, and then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. If you've read through the book of Judges, you know what's happened. They didn't do it. They let some of the inhabitants live there. And over time, in Judges, he said it's a series of cycles. Israel would get prosperity. They would lean towards their neighbors and they would take on these pagan ways and they would make God angry. And he would have those neighbors or a surrounding force come in and punish them. You think of Gideon. Gideon is hiding in a wine press when the angel comes to him. Why is he doing that? Because he wants the few grapes that they were stealing from him to keep his own self. And finally, they would cry out. They would humble themselves and God would rescue them and it would start all over again. Why? Because they didn't follow this. So much of their suffering and their history was brought on them. Now, you might be wondering about this picture. In Wednesday night, we've been studying through 1 and 2 Kings, and we recently studied through 2 Kings, a king named Ahab, Israel. The nation of Israel is divided. The northern 10 kingdoms are north, and they're Israel, and they are housed in Samaria. And this Israelite king by the name of Ahab married a woman from Tyre, a princess named Jezebel. I don't know anybody who has named their daughter Jezebel. Why? Because she was wicked. She was willful. And this is an artistic drawing of the prophet Elijah confronting them. Look at the eyes of Jezebel. I mean, do they capture wicked, evil, devious, vengeful? I mean, the artist did a great job. And this is the warning right here. If you leave these people intact, this is what you're going to end up with, because she manipulated Ahab, and Ahab was a pretty bad king because he married this woman. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and many of them were pagans, and look what they did to him. God says you can't cohabitate with this. Despite all the warnings of the prophets, year after year after year, finally God sent the Babylonians and he displaced Israel from the land. He plucked them out like a carrot out of the ground. The ones that survived were taken up to Babylon as captives for 70 years. Jerusalem, that beautiful city with the big temple of Solomon, was destroyed. All of the wealth and everything was taken. It was gone. It was wrecked. You get Lamentations written and it goes, what happened? How did this happen? It happened because they did not obey the Lord. There are consequences for disobedience. And God is true to his word. With a promise 700 years later or a warning several hundred years later. As we close this morning and we reflect, you might be wondering, what are we supposed to take away from this? And hopefully that's fairly plain. There is a clear result of obeying the Lord in his word, holding to your commitments, or following a path of willful disobedience. Either or. Now the tribes of Gad and Reuben promised Moses they would follow through. If you give us this land on the east side, we will go to war. And they did. They were honored their commitments, their pledge. They left their families over there in cities. They followed up with action, resolve, and God blessed them because they were in it wholeheartedly. Wholeheartedly. However, the majority of tribes, 10 and a half or 9 and a half of them went across, and they left the neighbors there. They left the seeds there. They left the problems there. They would eventually come back to haunt them over and over through the history and all the way to the time of Jesus, when nation after nation after nation. You know, the same two choices still are in effect for Christians. Some people trust in the Lord and they exist the rest of their life on the basic foundations of their salvation. We would call them antinomians. Those are people who just live and say, you know, I can sin, I can confess it, and I can just get by, and I know that my pension is guaranteed, I'm going to get a reward in heaven, and good for me. And there are people who build upon it with gold, silver, and precious stones. You know what the difference is? I get people that come to me in counseling, sometimes Christian people, who have lived on behind door number one on that bare foundation, and they wake up one day and they have all these problems, all of these things, and they come to me and they say, can you fix it in an hour or two? And I'm going, it took you decades to make it like this. How in the world am I going to fix it? You know what has to fix it? Number one, you have to confess your sin. You have to repent of it. And know that's the starting point. But you are going to have to go back and repair, you know, and I won't say it out loud, but you know what our governor said about the roads? Well, it's sort of the same thing. You know, it took years and years and years for our roads to get bad. And she does not have a magic wand. It takes money and time to do it, to repair those roads. It's the same thing with people's lives. You can't remove the past, but you can work towards fixing the future. My friend Charles Spurgeon sums it up like this. The cross is the danger signal to you. It warns you that if God spared not his own only son, he will not spare you. It is the lighthouse set on the rocks of sin to warn you that swift and sure destruction awaits you if you continue to rebel against the Lord. And that is not just for unbelievers. It's easy to point and say, yeah, you don't do that, you're going to hell. But what about a Christian? Same warning. Same warning. Mull over this week. What does it mean to be wholehearted? Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, Again, a surprisingly powerful message from Numbers. Moses' last sermon. And he tells the Israelites, you have a choice. You follow the Lord, or you go in your own way and deal with the consequences. We just ask you to teach us, to grow us, to use us in our lives that we are different, that we are not willing to live just at the base, at the foundation, but help us to grow, to build, to be different, to be your people, to be known as men and women of God. In your name we pray. Amen.